Hi, I'm Adrian Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 26, 2013. All this month, we're going back to the basics on Marketplace Money, those things you should know about personal finance. Today, investing.
I wish I knew how to invest and turn $1 into many more dollars.
Investing is something that I'm not, at this point in my life, ready to do. Maybe when I'm older, but right now I'm turning 22 and I'm not really looking to do the whole stock market thing.
To really know when you should maybe move or change something, you have to have a reliable investment advisor. And I have one and I trust him, but I mostly just leave my investments alone.
I mean, I'm young. I'm only 24 years old. If my money can sit there, and I mean, I've been around long enough to see the patterns of the stock market, so I see it's good right now, so I'm going to let it sit.
There's a lot of people, I mean, obviously, who with some very well-placed stocks can not have to work and continuously live off of that. So if you know how to do that, more power to you. I personally don't know how to do that. On Wall Street.
So that's one dream, investing in a few companies and just leaving your 9-to-5 behind. In reality, it doesn't happen so often. It's more of a long-term venture, putting your money somewhere it'll grow instead of disappear. And straight up, you should know this isn't going to be a show where you walk away with any hot stock tips. Instead, this hour is about the ideas and concepts you need to make choices for yourself. So let's start with two terms you hear all the time, active and passive. Both are key to understanding the investing landscape. We called up Justin Fox for a little help. He's author of The Myth of the Rational Market. Hi, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the basics here. Let's define the terms active versus passive investing. What are we talking about?
I mean, active investing is what people think of traditionally as investing, where someone picks the stocks that he or she thinks are going to go up more. And that's what most mutual fund managers do and hedge fund managers and all the rest.
So they actually know something about the landscape. They say, we think this company's undervalued. We're going to buy shares in this company.
Correct. Or, you know, it may be much less logical sounding reason like this stock has been going up for the last 3 months. We think it's going to keep going up, so we'll buy it. And passive means you just sort of decide ahead of time, either maybe you're going to own all the stocks in the S&P 500, or it can be pretty much any sort of thing you set up ahead of time, and then you just leave it. Or maybe you have automatic adjustments, but the idea is you're not making conscious decisions every day.
Can you walk through the arguments on both sides? Why do people say active investments make sense, and why do they say passive investments make sense?
The argument for active investing is that either you or someone you can choose knows better than the market where the market is going. Part of the issue here is some people do. There is actual skill in investing, and sometimes people are successful over pretty long periods of time in outperforming the market. So it's not complete nonsense to think that you could do that or somebody else could do that. As an individual, your big advantage is, you know, you're not a mutual fund manager. You're not having your performance checked every quarter and getting fired if you're, you know, way behind the S&P or some other index. And you could, in theory, stake out a sort of unique and against the contrarian investment strategy. The difficulty is, you know, most people are either both psychologically and just in terms of how much time they have to give to it, not capable of doing that very well. When it comes to actually hiring somebody to manage money for you, it gets in a lot of ways even harder simply because it's just so hard to tell whether someone has any skill. It's very hard to tell if someone's past outperformance is just pure luck or has something to do with skill.
And what about the arguments for passive investing?
The biggest argument for it is it's much cheaper. That an index fund isn't better if they're charging fees just as high as an active fund. The whole point of an index fund is that it should be super, super cheap. And they should be charging you a much lower percentage. It should be way lower than a percent for the most part per year to manage your money. If on the whole, your active money managers are going to just track or slightly trail the market and your index funds are going to do the same thing, but your index funds are charging maybe a percent less per year to do that, then if you invested in index funds, if you were a passive investor, you've come out way ahead.
So pay attention to those fees first and foremost.
Yes.
Now, the market has been on a bit of a tear recently, and I wonder what that means for active investors and passive investors. I mean, good for passive investors, right? We know things have gone up.
Yeah, I mean, and it's good for a lot of active investors, too. I think the biggest danger anytime the market's moving around a lot is that it's going to make some active investors look really brilliant when all they are is either reckless or lucky or both. And so it's actually, in a time of volatility, it gets even harder to judge whether an active investor knows what he or she is doing than in calmer days.
For the average person, you know, for listeners with just a little money to invest or some money to invest, how should they pick an approach?
I think you start with passive. You don't invest actively, either doing it yourself or picking active mutual fund managers, unless you have some reason to think that you can do it better than the average person. And I know we all think we're above average and the like, but I think with investing, it's possible to be honest with yourself. And sort of, I'm somebody who started out, I thought it was much more fun to buy individual stocks and buy mutual funds doing weird things. And partly out of personal experience and partly out of spending a lot of time researching the history of financial theory, I finally realized it's just dumb. I mean, somebody can do that well, but it's not me. And so if you're just starting out and you don't know where to go, you got to start out with index funds.
Justin Fox is author of The Myth of the Rational Market. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got a discussion going on our Facebook page about your best investment advice. Roger writes, if you can't explain it to your friends and family in terms they understand, it isn't a legitimate investment, or you don't understand it well enough to invest in it. Active or passive isn't the only question an investor has to decide. There are CDs, index funds, mutual funds, bond funds, muni bonds. It goes on and on. There's just so many investing choices. And it can leave a lot of us wondering if we should be investing at all. So for our entree into the world of portfolios, trading, and risk, we've asked Jill Schlesinger to be our navigator. She's a CBS News business analyst and an investment expert. Hey, Jill.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening.
Thank you. So first off, do beginners really belong investing? Are they just going to get crushed by the people who do this for a living?
First of all, the people who do it for a living, and I used to be one of those people because my first job on Wall Street was a trader, don't know that much more than you do.
Okay.
They just act like they do. but I think that before you start investing, you should try to familiarize yourself with the basic concept of putting your own money to work. Means you have to understand that there are all different types of things you can invest in, different
right.
asset classes, right? And so we break them down. Most people have heard of stocks and bonds mm-hmm. and cash, right? Cash is the easiest one to get, right? Ooh, I get that one. That's cool. The next one is a bond, which is basically an IOU. You lend money to some entity and they hang on to that money for a while and pay you interest along the way. And at the end of some term, they give you the money back.
Got it.
So you can lend that to a company, a municipality, hopefully not Detroit, and you can lend that to the government, the U.S. government. So that's the bond. You also have a stock or equities, and stock is just investing in a company that is publicly traded. So the thing about stocks and why they get people kind of nutty is that in a short period of time, they can be quite volatile. Over a longer period of time, they do tend to return more than cash or bonds. But at any given moment, like during the financial crisis, stocks can look pretty awful as
right.
an investment.
Be kind of a nightmare.
Right.
We have listeners like you on the line with questions about how to invest. Jill, are you ready for them?
I'm ready to rock.
All right. The first caller is Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what's your question?
Well, I'm 29, and I have about $10,000 that I'd like to set aside for retirement. And so I was thinking of putting the money in something like an index fund. But I'm wondering, with the stock market so high right now, would it be smart to wait a little bit to see if it comes down or only put a portion of that money into an index fund?
Now, this is a question I have too, Jill. You don't want to be the guy who chases the top only to lose everything, right?
Oh, Elizabeth, if only I knew where the top and the bottom were, we would be so rich. We could figure it out together. The problem is that I just don't know whether the next leg is 10% higher or 10% lower. And I don't really think a lot of people know that, frankly. So one way that you can take a more measured approach is that you can do something called dollar cost averaging. And that would mean that of your $10,000, you set aside a certain amount or a percentage of that amount to go into an index fund on a periodic basis. So maybe you say for the next 10 months, I'll put $1,000 a month into an index fund.
Why do that, Jill? I'm going to stop you. Just talk us through, why does that make more sense than just tossing those $10,000 in today?
Well, it only makes sense if the stock market's going down.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's going down, but let's say the stock market is going down. Let's say Elizabeth is right. She's got a feeling that things are topping out. And a month from now, instead of the Dow being at 15.4, it's at 15. And so she's put $1,000 in. And the next month, she's putting $1,000 in at a lower level. And if we see a decline over the next 10 months, then Elizabeth will be buying shares at an average price that's lower overall, right? So if you put all of your money to work at once and the market then subsequently falls, then you're just stuck with that price. You put a little bit in every single month and the market goes down, you'll be better off. But here's the problem. If the market keeps going higher for the next 10 months, then you're putting $1,000 a month away for 10 months, and the market keeps marching higher, and you may, in fact, find that you would have been better off putting the $10,000 in as a lump sum. The academic research shows, just to be wonky on you, that when people put lump sums to work, it is usually more beneficial than dollar cost averaging, even if the market were to fall. The problem is, if you're the kind of person who's going to drive yourself crazy because you put your $10,000 in at the top and then the market goes down and then you're going to sell out, then just stick to dollar cost averaging. If you're the kind of person who says, I just want to get my money invested, I'm in it for the next 30 years, then do a lump sum.
Yeah, I mean, I plan on just putting it in and letting it sit there until I retire. So it sounds like putting it in as a lump sum might make more sense.
You know, you're really young, and if you're thinking about this for retirement, even if you put your money in today and today is a near-term top, it will not be the top 30 years from now. That's the one thing I can guarantee you.
Great.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest this hour is CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, and we're tackling the basics of investing. All right, Jill, we're now going to Aaron from Richmond, Virginia. Aaron, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. And Jill, to introduce you to Aaron, she's actually one of the most active Facebook friends Marketplace Money has. Aaron, how long have you been listening to the show?
Probably a year and a half. You know, me and my husband have a couple of income properties and, you know, just weren't really that financially literate, I guess, when we started out. And we just had a baby in November.
Congratulations.
So, thinking about him.
Well, thank you so much for listening and for commenting on our Facebook page. What's your question for Jill?
Well, I was actually watching a Frontline, and it was called The Retirement Game. And they mentioned the best thing to invest in was actually what the previous caller said was an index fund. And I was just wondering, how would one go about, I guess, putting money into an account like that, and you know, to avoid fees, because I've just heard so many bad things about, you know, fees for those kinds of accounts.
That's a great question. The show is called actually The Retirement Gamble. So part of The Retirement Gamble was talking about how the shift in retirement over the last 30 years in America has really gone from a burden of employers to us, the employees. And so many of us first started investing, not because we were little Richie Riches, because we had these things called 401ks. Mm-hmm. And so the story in The Retirement Gamble gets, there's a very pointed exchange about index funds. And so what is an index fund? An index fund is a mutual fund that goes out and just replicates one of the indices that's out there in the universe. So it's the S&P 500, 500 U.S. companies. It could be an index that represents the Russell 2000, small company stocks. And the beauty of an index fund is that it is a passive investment. So they just buy the stuff that's in the index, and the mutual fund leaves it alone. So you're not paying for research, and you're not paying someone to figure out to make the best trade or not. It's just the index. And as a result, the fees of an index fund are way lower than the average fee for a managed mutual fund. So we're talking maybe it's, I think the I don't even know at this point. I think the S&P 500 index offered through Vanguard is now 0.07.
Okay.
Percent, like 0.07%,
wow,
cost annually, whereas the average managed mutual fund, I think as of last year, is maybe about 0.8% to 1%. So what's the advantage there? Well, think about it, Aaron. You're investing and you invest and you had a managed fund. You literally starting the year at -1%, right? Because that's the cost of the fund. Whereas with that index fund, you've got a big advantage. You've got that, you know, almost full percent that's in your pocket. And when you look at the performance of index funds versus the managed fund universe, it may be shocking to all the people in the mutual fund industry who love to talk about stock picking and how brilliant they are, but they don't beat the index. So I love index funds, and there's a lot of different places where you can buy an index fund. Some of the larger companies that offer index funds are Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price. Those are, yeah, and you can also buy them through brokerage accounts through Charles Schwab or TD Ameritrade. But those mutual fund companies are offering lots of different kinds of funds, but I would suggest that you really stick to the index funds within there and within their fund offerings.
Okay.
And you could just put a little bit of money away every single month. You can have, I think for many of these funds, it's as little as $50, maybe $100 a month. Have them take it right out of your bank account. You do an auto draft. And you're on your way.
Okay, great.
Now, how do you compare these costs, Jill? Where do you find these fee numbers to compare?
Well, you know, I'm sure that you've read your mutual fund prospectus when you've had some horrible bout of something. You're like, oh, I can't get to sleep.
I've memorized.
Yeah. They used to be printed on that little thin oniony paper.
Right,
by
in really tiny 6-point font.
Right. Sadistic lawyers create those. So now the easiest place is you actually can literally type in the name of the index fund. You can say Vanguard 500 Index. And there's a part of every single website that says fees.
Okay.
And you're going and looking at the fees and you will see them compared to other index funds. I mean, one index fund, quite frankly, is no different than another because they both, if they're the same index, right? So it may just be that you like the interface of the Vanguard platform better than the Fidelity platform, or it may be that you have your Fidelity 401k is, you know, is your employer plan and you want to use that. It's not that different. But I will say, really, that there's, as much as I have so many friends who are traders who try to tell me differently, and I keep saying to them, but there is no evidence. The evidence is really in the favor of index funds. So I don't know why I would ever tell anyone to drive themselves crazy and try to find the best managed fund.
Okay.
Aaron, thank you again for calling and for participating on our Facebook page. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, Jill, now we're on to Statesville, North Carolina. Corrine, are you with us now?
I am here.
So tell us a little. I understand you have a question about retirement investments.
Yes, I do. And I do want to say that I have my daughter's 529s in index funds, so that made me very good to hear the end of that comment there. I am a teacher, so I'm eligible for 403B savings plans, and I've had them for a number of years. I had one fund for a number of years and just kind of felt that, I don't know why, just maybe thought it wasn't performing very well, so I switched over my investments to another firm. And I'm trying, I just don't know how to make sure that the money isn't going in the right place.
That's a great question. I have found, you know, in my previous life as a financial planner that 403B plans are very thorny. When they were first offered, in addition to pensions for employees, what would happen is that there was just going to be a company. You didn't have a choice to say, hey, here's company A, and this is what your choice is. And during the evolution of, you know, the industry, many more plans were offered. So the first thing is, the easiest way to compare it is to say, what is the cost of investing in each of these different plans? Generally speaking, I'm going to give myself a caveat here so I don't get bashed by all my insurance friends. Generally speaking, the plans offered through insurance companies, which are often variable annuities, are expensive. And so why are we doing this to our people, right? Why are we doing this to our employees? So the first thing you need to do, Corinne, is to talk to someone in your HR or benefits department and say, hey, what's up with this? Can we get a no-load choice? Can we get a cheaper choice for investing than these guys? Because this is not very good. If you're left with tough luck, lady, you get what you get, which is what many people are left with, then the way to look at it is to first, the first layer of fees that are charged are the plan fees. And by the way, you should be getting, I believe, at least once a year and probably quarterly, an outline of how much these plans cost. That was actually a new rule.
I have a statement sitting in front of me right now that for this quarter, it showed a certain amount of fees incurred, and I divided that into the value of my beginning balance, and it was 0.4%.
Right. And so, like, you know, can I say this in a nice way? Like, that's kind of like you're getting hosed, you know, because you're now paying 1.6% a year. And if you think about, like, well, 1.6%, that doesn't sound so bad, except that many index funds are a tenth of 1%. So why should... You know, this is part of, you know, my frustration with the industry, which I love so much, but it makes me insane. Why are we saying to people that it's okay to pay an extra 1.5% a year? Why is that okay? It's not.
Okay.
And you want to be a rabble rouser? You say, hey, you know, don't you want a better plan? That's my favorite thing when I used to say to people, like, well, don't you, doesn't your boss want a better plan?
Right.
No, I want to do it for everybody. And if you can get a group of people together, it's actually very easy to add different parts of a 403B plan now. It's much easier than it used to be.
So basically go to the human resources and find out what my choices are.
Absolutely.
And then if I don't like the choices, then try to find a different choice that they can then adopt.
Right. Just say, hey, can't you guys just slice a deal out with Fidelity or Vanguard and make that a choice? What's the big deal? It's no big deal for us. How about that?
That sounds good. I'll look into that.
Corinne, good luck with your HR department. I hope it goes well for you.
Thank you very much.
Jill, we are making excellent progress, I think, in our headway into understanding the basics of investing. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about bonds. We'll be right back. Investment expert Jill Schlesinger is with us today answering your questions about investing. Jill, before we get back to the phones, I want to ask a question out of the news a little bit, which is about the bond market.
Yeah.
And that's this. My understanding is that as interest rates go up, bond funds are going to fall. So what do you do? What's it mean?
Well, I mean, interest rates have already gone up.
Right.
We've had a huge increase. If you think about it, we went from 1.6% the beginning of May in the 10-year Treasury yield. That's the intermediate term lending benchmark with Uncle Sam. So you could lend Uncle Sam money for 10 years and get paid 1.6%. It's popped all the way up to 2.6%. 2.6 is still really low. It's just that move within a short period of time is quite sudden.
Right.
Hasn't happened, by the way. The full percentage point move has not happened like that since 1994. So what do you do? Well, I'm not a fan of getting out of asset classes completely.
Okay.
So I'm not a fan of saying dump every single bond you own. However, I think that knowing that we are in a rising interest rate market, it's not going to happen immediately, there's a few things you can do to protect yourself. Number one, instead of using just government bonds, you can have a mix of bonds. You can have some corporate bonds that would help you out. You would want to keep your duration, which is basically how long you're lending money for, to the shorter side, you know, so that you say instead of lending for 30 years, you say, oh, I'm going to lend for 5 years. And you might even keep a little bit of cash on hand because as interest rates rise and bond prices fall, you can buy some bonds at lower prices.
Right.
But all in all, don't blow out of bonds completely. And if you have a fixed account in your retirement account in fund, if you're looking at if you're a TIAA CREF investor and you've got the fixed account or a bond fund, you can use the fixed account and that will not fluctuate at all.
Great. So our last call today is from Ron in North Carolina. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Ron, it sounds like you've had quite a sort of up and down experience in the market in the last 10 or 15 years. So tell us your story. What's going on?
Well, I retired from an airline back in 2002. And the retirement fund that I had when I retired, I invested it into a brokerage account, 50% in stocks and 50% in bonds. And was devastated by the outcome of that. So I lost a considerable amount of my retirement fund that I was blessed with when I retired. In 2005, we moved over to a brokerage firm and invested through Goldman Sachs funds heavily in that particular environment. And before the big fallout in 2008 and 2009, prayerfully, we did look at everything and sold a great percentage of these funds, so we didn't lose everything. We lost a little bit, but not the total amount that would have been lost if we'd kept it in a little bit longer. Since that time, we've been with Vanguard and have what we have basically done is invested in individual stocks, one of which was an airline stock, and we doubled our actual IRA through this one airline through several buys and sells at lows and highs.
Ron, you sound like an active investor, and I wonder, how have your experiences been with fund managers?
Basically, what we felt like was the economy, as we all know, in 08 and 09 collapsed, but we felt like we had some bad advice, and we went with it because we were just new kids on the block, and we were just trusting these people to guide us in the right direction, and that was the main driving force why we went into managing these individual stocks for the last 3 or 4 years.
And Jill, I mean, how do you decide that you can have confidence in somebody when it's your money and when you have had these negative experiences in the past?
Well, I think that confidence and trust are very big, but I also think that there may be a point in your life where you have to recognize that maybe you aren't ready to do this for the rest of your life and you may be beyond your own abilities, or you got super lucky for this period of time and now you don't want to blow it again. You know, you can't be guaranteed. There's bad guys and gals out there that do stuff, but primarily it's an industry filled with people who actually want to help you. So I think that if you try to stick with people who are fee only or fee based, if you stick with people who are registered as investment advisors, and that means they have to put your needs before their needs or their company's needs, and you talk to a few different people and you get some feedback, that's something that's worthwhile for Ron and his wife, because of their bad experiences, they're going to have to really go slowly and try to, someone's going to have to work hard to win their trust. And I don't blame you, Ron. It's, you know, there's lots of bad things about the industry, but I do get the sense that you have been unbelievably fortunate that you may have experience in this business, in the airline industry, and you got real lucky with this stock that maybe could have, you know, just, you know, done the opposite and hurt you. And I don't want you to give up the money that you've made. So
right.
I'd like to try to put a few insurance policies in place on that.
Exactly.
So Ron, what do you think you're going to do?
I think that's good advice. You know, we're going to follow up on what, you know, what we're all about here today and look into some other investment advisors and go from there. But, you know, I think we definitely are open to things that would be less involvement for us and more of a balanced and kind of a continuity type plan that would hold us true and still give us some return for the next few years. So I'm open to that.
Well, Ron, good luck to you. Let us know how it turns out.
All right. I appreciate you.
Thanks for calling.
You bet. Bye-bye.
And Jill, before we let you go, President Obama is starting this campaign-style tour about the economy and the middle class. And one thing he's been talking about is retirement and saving for retirement. And I wonder, before I let you go, do you have any thoughts about what he ought to be saying, what you'd like to hear from him?
Oh, I have so many lists of things that I'd like to. I can't even put that in like a reasonable time frame. He should say that, you know, everyone can make a difference. He should say go out and do good things in the world. I don't know. I think that one of the things that the president and many people in politics fall back on is this concept that if we just are all financially literate, everything will be better. And I think that's baloney. I think that plenty of people who are super smart and understand their finances make lots of dumb choices. And it's very emotional. It's just that, you know, presidents have too much, they get too much credit when the economy goes well, and they get too much blame when the economy goes poorly. And there's many things to say about that. But I would like the president to really stress that just, you know, figuring out how a bond works is not what the ultimate goal is. The ultimate goal is to create a disciplined approach to managing your financial life at the earliest possible age.
Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and personal finance expert. A link to her blog, Jill on Money, is on our website, marketplacemoney.org. We're also taking your questions there and on our Facebook page for next week's show, all about debt and credit. We're devoting today's show to the basics of investing. Earlier this hour, a couple of experts advised us the most sensible way to invest is to pick an index fund, a collection of stocks or bonds that mirror a particular market index or reflect a certain sector, like technology. But there's also another way to invest, actively picking your own stocks and bonds for your portfolio, or hiring a money manager to select stocks for you. Some folks really like this approach, so we asked Shayna Steiner to explain active investing. She's the investing editor of Bankrate.com. Welcome, Shayna.
Hi.
So what do you absolutely have to know before you start active investing?
Well, you should know that it's going to cost a little bit more, and you should know why you're paying more. Sometimes it's worth it. A lot of the time, it might not be.
One thing we heard earlier in the show is that a booming market makes everyone look like the world's best investor. And I wonder how you go about picking someone to manage your money, or maybe a fund that is managed, when everyone's sort of showing good results.
That is the trick. What you can do is go back and see how the fund has done in varying economic situations. You know, what happened in 2008? Did the fund lose as much as the broad market? Did it lose more? Did it lose less? And that'll give you some indication on, you know, how it'll do in different situations.
And what if you want to do this picking yourself? I mean, where do you start as an individual investor, maybe picking individual stocks?
Well, you could start by looking at companies that you know of already. Look into mutual funds. Look at what like a large cap mutual fund might hold. They'll hold really big companies, and you can look in their top 10 holdings and start investigating what companies you see most often.
What sort of trouble do individual investors wind up in?
They wind up timing the market really poorly. They buy high and sell low, chasing performance, and maybe overweighting one particular investment rather than diversifying.
So don't throw everything into Apple stock just because you like your iPhone.
It's really risky to bet the farm on one stock, and buying a bunch, whether it's through a mutual fund or buying a bunch of individual stocks, is much less risky.
When you're at a dinner party with your friends and or people that you have never met before and you tell them what you do, what are the questions about investing that they ask you?
They ask me what they should put their money into. I've spoken to so many investment professionals that now my answer is automatically, it depends on what your risk tolerance is and all of that. If you have a high risk tolerance, you're willing to see your account balance take a pretty precipitous drop. If you don't want to take any risk at all, you don't want to see your account balance move much.
And I actually went online this week and took a risk tolerance test and found out I have average risk tolerance. But are those tests, I mean, should they actually guide how I invest?
Somewhat. I've heard it referred to as kind of a sleep at night meter. If you're the type of person who's going to stay awake and fret over your 401k balance, regardless of how much time you have, then it should somewhat guide you. Mm-hmm. But other things are also important considerations. For instance, how much money you want to have at retirement or how much money you need to have at retirement.
So what is the very worst investment story that you have ever heard, Shayna?
That would probably be my own worst investment story. Yeah. When I first started working, I put all of my 401k money into an aggressive growth fund. Mm-hmm. And also one technology stock. This was in the tech boom. And then it all crashed and I sold and cashed out my 401k.
Wow.
I ended up leaving that job and I did exactly what they say not to do. Cashed out my 401k, paid off some bills, started over with nothing.
Why?
I needed the money. The same reason everyone does it. You think, well, maybe I'll have more money later in my life. So I learned my lesson early.
Do you look back on it as a choice that you would do it differently, or do you feel like it was a choice you had to make?
I would absolutely do it differently. Definitely. Knowing what I know now, if you just leave money alone and you save a few thousand dollars in your 20s, by the time you retire at 60, you're going to have so much more money than somebody who starts at 35.
Shayna Steiner is the investing editor of Bankrate.com. Thanks so much, Shayna.
Thank you, Adrian.
We got another investing tip from one of our Facebook friends, Karen. Don't watch the market highs and lows, she says, and don't act with emotion. For some people, investing is about more than making money. It's about morals, too. Basically, putting your cash in companies that share your values. But doing that isn't always easy. Raj Sisodia is the F.W. Olin Distinguished Professor of Global Business at Babson College. He's also co-founder of Conscious Capitalism, Inc. Raj, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
So what do we mean by socially responsible investing? What are we really talking about here?
We prefer to think of it as socially aligned investing. In other words, companies have many effects on the world. You know, businesses create but can also potentially destroy not just financial wealth. So it's important when we look at businesses to look at the totality of the consequences or the impacts that they have on the world and to look for businesses where they are aligning financial wealth creation with other forms of value creation at the same time. So it's not a trade-off.
So we asked our listeners about their questions about aligning sort of their values or morals with their investing dollars. And Kristen wrote in. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. Thanks for talking to me today.
What are the values, when you're thinking about investing, what are the values that are important to you?
Thinking of like how we use and oftentimes abuse the resources on this planet. And then another big category that I think is important is looking at companies that I guess would treat their employees with dignity and respect, paying a living wage or having working conditions that are safe and comfortable. I have a few retirement accounts set up, and when I met with the financial planner to set those up, I did mention to him that I was interested in trying to invest in companies that I felt were more aligned with my values. And he said he didn't recommend it because that I wouldn't get as good of a return on my investment and that I'd have to pay more to have my accounts managed more closely because like they might get kind of out of whack.
And Kristen, what did you say when your financial planner said it didn't make sense? What did you decide to do?
So I just stuck with the kind of the typical portfolio that they use with their company. I did at some point a little bit later kind of try to look into doing a more socially responsible investing, and I just got really overwhelmed with all the information and options out there.
So what should somebody like Kristen do?
Well, there are some proxies that one can look for. I mean, if you have a very specific set of values, it's different. But if you're generally looking for companies that are good places to work, that are good citizens, that are good trustees in a sense, they're good stewards of the environment, looking after their people, they're probably producing products and services that are good for customers and so forth. There are some proxies. Great places to work, I think, is a good proxy because if a company is recognized as a meaningful place to work, then it is clearly doing some other things right as well. The most ethical companies in the world list also, I think, has some value in that regard. We have done our own research and in a book that came out a few years ago called Firms of Endearment. We took a more holistic view of this and looked at companies that were loved by all of their stakeholders, customers, employees, suppliers, communities, etc., as well as had some other elements in common, what we call a higher purpose, as well as conscious leadership.
There are sort of socially responsible mutual funds that you can invest in today as an investor. What do you make of those funds?
Those funds generally have not delivered very good returns. So there might have been a slight penalty to the overall market in terms of investing in that. And some people are of course, fine with that. I think that imposes a trade-off that is simply not necessary. Because if you really think about it, creating those kinds of value is also aligned with creating financial value. In today's world where people are better informed, they're better connected, they're more intelligent, you know, you've got all of these, they've got a value system that is more aligned with purpose and meaning. Increasingly, the companies that are able to create value are the ones that are in harmony with all of those changes. So I think that trade-off that we have felt we have to make in the past is really not necessary anymore.
Kristen, thank you so much for your call. And Raj, thank you too.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Raj Sisodia is a professor of global business at Babson College. If you've got advice about investing, share it with us. We've got quite a list going on our Facebook page. Shelley says invest early and often. We've also gathered up all your tips on our website, marketplacemoney.org. While we're on the subject of investment, we thought it might be time for you to invest in some good books for the summer. So here are a few suggestions.
I'm Kelly Grant, a reporter for CNBC.com, and the book that I'm reading this summer is The Plateau Effect by Bob Sullivan and Hugh Thompson. I think it's a smart book for people to take a look at because everyone does hit a plateau. As they point out in the book, they're fairly common, everything from if you're trying to lose some weight, maybe even trying to get a promotion. And it might not come across necessarily as a straight money book, but if you think about it, there are a lot of money applications. A lot of people are trying to get a raise, they are trying to build their career, maybe even build a business, and just any of the habits that you might have built from saving money. So it's got some interesting strategies there that really can benefit consumers.
Hello, my name is Dr. Neela Richardson. I'm an economist and analyst for Bloomberg Government in Washington, D.C. The book I'd like to recommend is Detroit, An American Autopsy by Charlie LaDuff. Mr. LaDuff is a journalist and native of the Detroit suburbs. His book chronicles the rise and fall of one of America's most iconic cities. At one time, Detroit symbolized all that was the best about America. It had a large manufacturing base, high levels of homeownership, and a blue-collar work ethic. But Detroit, like so many American cities, is now in tatters since the financial crisis. LaDuff provides a gripping tale of crime, political scandal, and economic hardship, all great ingredients for a summer book read.
Hi, my name is Ramit Sethi. I'm the author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich. My book recommendation is not a typical money book. It's actually a book on food called Mindless Eating by Cornell professor Brian Wansink. Now, for many of us, food, just like with money, is one of our top worries. We know we should spend less, just like we know we should eat less. We also believe we're in control. But mindless eating shows us how our own psychology works against us to make us eat more and spend more than we even realize. And then Wansink shows us some fascinating solutions. I hope you enjoy the book.
And you can find our entire list from our summer reading series. Just go to marketplacemoney.org and click on the summer reading link. And on our Facebook page, listeners are sharing their choices. William suggests The 4-Hour Workweek by Timothy Ferris. A 4-Hour Workweek sounds pretty good to me. Here's a familiar sound for investors, big and small. The opening bell on Wall Street, and at the end of each trading session, we get a numerical measure of stock performance for the day. One of the things we all watch is the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or the Dow. But what goes into that Dow calculation? Where's the number really come from? It's time to solve another money mystery.
Mortgage-backed securities.
Look what Scooby
if you're
found!
To keep the level of yield in your portfolio constant.
What do you think it means?
Subsidized, unsubsidized.
I don't know, but something tells me we'll soon find out.
Today, Marketplace's Patty Hirsch explains the thinking behind the Dow.
Imagine we discovered an island in the Pacific. 15,000 men, women, and children live on the island, which is divided into several tribes. Now, imagine a bunch of scientists wanted to measure the productivity of this population. They could study just one of the tribes, but that wouldn't really give them an accurate picture. The best way, of course, is to track the output of every single man, woman, and child on the island. But that would be unimaginably difficult and very expensive. So the scientists look for a shortcut. They select 30 people, men and women, from a variety of tribes and monitor them. The people are in their most productive term of life. And the scientists can swap them out with other people when they become sick or aged, or of course if they die. Now the DAO is just like those 30 study subjects. It's a careful selection of 30 of the biggest and healthiest of the roughly 15,000 publicly traded companies in the US. And we watch the DAO closely because it's a quick way to take the temperature of the stock market, which so many of us are invested in. When the index was created in 1885, the scientists were journalists. Today they're researchers employed by a company called the CME Group. But their mission remains the same, to monitor the health of corporate America by studying a carefully chosen sample of 30 of its biggest firms.
Patty Hirsch is the senior producer of Personal Finance at Marketplace and the author of Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple. Do you have a money mystery that you'd like us to solve on air? We'd be happy to do some sleuthing for you. Just tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank. And if you're not on Twitter, it's not a problem. You can always send us a message at marketplacemoney.org. We're coming to the end of the show on investing, and we've tossed out a whole lot of terms today.
Asset classes.
S&P 500.
Mutual funds.
Fees.
Interest rate.
Bonds.
The market.
Diversifying.
Index funds.
403B.
Individual stocks.
Higher risk.
Timing the market.
Cash.
It can be absolutely dizzying, I know. But we have four take-home points from today's show, and we'll have this list on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Takeaway one from Justin Fox, author of The Myth of the Rational Market.
If you're just starting out and you don't know where to go, you got to start out with index funds.
Andy says, watch out for those fees, even with an index fund.
It should be super, super cheap, and they should be charging you a much lower percentage. It should be way lower than a percent, for the most part, per year to manage your money.
Takeaway three from the always charming Jill Schlesinger, stay diversified. It's the long-term play that matters.
I'm not a fan of getting out of asset classes completely. So I'm not a fan of saying dump every single bond you own.
And takeaway four from our Facebook friend, Paul, stop trying to time the market. And if you want more, a lot more, including some specific investing questions answered by Marketplace's Chris Farrell, including the difference between owning a bond and a bond fund, we've got it all on marketplacemoney.org. That'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Next time, we continue our personal finance basics with what you need to know about credit and debt.
When it comes to debt, modern society, contemporary times, has a ton of baggage.
Share your experiences about debt and credit with us and ask us your questions. Go to our website at marketplacemoney.org, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali, with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata, and help this week from Raghu Manavalan. Ravi Karman is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Adrienne Hill. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.